The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents Epistemic Firewalls, Judgment in the Age of Synthetic Media. Topic Introduction. In 2026, it is no longer enough to ask whether information is available. The harder question is whether people can still think clearly enough to decide what deserves their trust. Synthetic media, engagement-optimized platforms, and the constant competition for attention have changed the conditions under which belief forms. Text can be polished, images can be persuasive, voices can sound familiar, and videos can feel like direct evidence. At the same time, those same systems learn what keeps people reacting, returning, and sharing. So the central problem is not simply that there is more information. It is that the environment itself now presses on judgment.
This lecture is for adult learners who want more than slogans about media literacy and more than cynicism. It is for students, professionals, and engaged readers who already understand that modern life is full of claims, but who want a better framework for judging them. It is especially useful for anyone who works under uncertainty, makes decisions that matter, or depends on trustworthy information in a crowded digital world. The aim is not to make anyone permanently suspicious. The aim is to strengthen judgment so that evidence, not noise, has the final say.
At the center of the lecture is a simple but demanding idea: epistemic agency. That means the capacity to manage attention, belief, and reasoning in line with evidence, uncertainty, and real-world goals. It is the ability to notice what is entering the mind, test it rather than merely absorb it, and calibrate confidence so that conviction tracks support. When that capacity weakens, people do not only become more vulnerable to falsehood, they also become more vulnerable to overload, emotional manipulation, and the quiet drift from careful judgment into automatic reaction.
The challenge is that human beings are not built to inspect everything with equal intensity. We have limited working memory, limited attention, and limited energy for sustained self-control. Under stress, uncertainty, or repeated interruption, the mind leans harder on shortcuts. Familiarity can start to look like truth. Fluency can feel like credibility. A compelling story can outrun a messy reality. None of this is a sign of stupidity. It is what happens when normal cognition meets an information environment that is increasingly designed to capture and steer attention.
That is why this lecture uses the idea of a cognitive firewall. The phrase is a metaphor, but a useful one. It does not mean rejecting everything or withdrawing from public life. It means building habits that regulate what enters, how it is evaluated, and when confidence should harden or soften. In practice, that means learning how to reduce preventable load, slow interpretation at key moments, and review judgments after the fact so that errors become teachable rather than repeated.
The larger question running through the lecture is this: how can people remain mentally free when so much of the modern information environment is built to be persuasive, sticky, and fast? We will begin with the stakes, then move into the mechanisms that make judgment harder, and finally turn to the habits and supports that protect it. Along the way, the focus remains practical. The goal is not perfect certainty. It is the ability to hold beliefs firmly enough to act, but lightly enough to revise when better evidence appears. If that sounds ambitious, it should. The real issue is not whether people can ever be mistaken. Everyone can. The issue is whether they can preserve enough control over attention, belief, and reasoning to remain answerable to reality. That is the work ahead.
End of introduction. The central issue in 2026 is not only that people face more information. The deeper issue is that synthetic media and engagement-optimized distribution
change the conditions under which belief forms. The modern information environment does not merely add more claims to evaluate. It alters how attention is captured, how credibility is inferred, how familiarity is built, and how quickly a feeling of certainty can arrive.
That shift matters, because belief formation is not a side effect of information exposure. It is one of the main arenas where power operates. When text, images, audio, and video can be produced at scale, and when distribution systems learn what keeps people reacting, the challenge is no longer only finding facts. The challenge is preserving the ability to decide, carefully, what to believe, how strongly to believe it, and when to revise. A useful name for that ability is epistemic agency.
The word epistemic points to knowledge, evidence, and justified belief. Agency points to the capacity to act deliberately rather than being pushed entirely by circumstance. Put together, epistemic agency is the capacity to manage beliefs, attention, and reasoning in alignment with evidence, uncertainty, and goals. It includes the ability to notice what is entering the mind, to test it instead of merely absorbing it, and to calibrate confidence so conviction tracks support rather than impulse.
That definition is important because it shifts the conversation away from a shallow question. The shallow question is whether people are clever enough to avoid being fooled. The more serious question is whether people have the conditions, habits, and supports required for sound judgment. Epistemic agency is not a compliment for the wise and a condemnation of the gullible. It is protective infrastructure. People build it, maintain it, and sometimes lose it under pressure. If someone accepts a polished falsehood, that does not automatically reveal low intelligence. It may reveal an environment that rewards speed over verification, emotional fit over careful testing, and repetition over reflection. It may also reveal ordinary cognitive limits doing exactly what they do under load. That is why this lecture treats epistemic agency as practical protection rather than a moral verdict.
The goal is not to rank minds as superior or inferior. The goal is to understand what helps judgment remain reliable when the surrounding environment is designed to be persuasive, sticky, and fast. A useful way to picture this protection is as a cognitive firewall. The phrase is a metaphor, but it points to something concrete. A cognitive firewall is not a wall against all information. It is not a command to distrust everything, withdraw from public life, or reject unfamiliar claims on principle. Total closure would not protect judgment. It would damage it. Instead, a cognitive firewall is a set of routines for deciding what enters, how it is evaluated, and when beliefs should be updated. It regulates intake. It slows key moments of interpretation. It creates checks before confidence hardens. It also preserves mental space, so attention is not spent everywhere at once.
In practice, it asks disciplined questions. What deserves immediate attention, and what can wait? What counts as initial evidence, and what is only surface polish? What level of confidence is justified now, and what must remain provisional? What would change this conclusion if better information appeared? These are not abstract philosophical questions. They are daily operating questions for anyone who works, decides, evaluates, or advises under uncertainty. The important point is that the firewall protects judgment by shaping process, not by promising perfect outcomes. It does not guarantee that error disappears. No human system can do that. What it can do is reduce preventable error, slow premature certainty, and make revision easier when evidence changes.
That last point leads to a claim that can feel counterintuitive at first. In a more manipulative information environment, the answer is not simply harder mental work. Strained cognition is fragile cognition. If a person tries to inspect everything with maximum intensity,
they soon run into exhaustion, impatience, and overload. The better goal is refinement. Refinement means learning to synthesize, using metacognition, and relying on stable internal standards. Synthesis is bringing pieces together instead of reacting to each piece in isolation. A single post, clip, or image may feel decisive. Many judgments become reliable only when multiple signals are compared, weighed, and placed in context.
Metacognition is thinking about one's own thinking. It is the habit of noticing, in real time, when a claim feels compelling because it is well-supported, and when it feels compelling because it is vivid, flattering, alarming, or familiar. Stable internal standards are decisions made in advance about what counts as enough evidence for belief, sharing, or action. Without standards, confidence becomes reactive. It rises with mood, urgency, and social pressure. With standards, confidence becomes more disciplined. A person is not deciding from scratch every time a claim appears. They already have criteria for source quality, corroboration, uncertainty, and revision. This is a quieter form of strength than constant suspicion. It is also more sustainable. The goal is not to think harder about everything. The goal is to think more cleanly about what matters, and to know when to pause, when to investigate, and when to leave a claim in suspense. This is where human-in-the-loop judgment becomes especially important. In an environment saturated with generated material, the scarce capability is not merely producing plausible content. The scarce capability is interpretive judgment under responsibility. Human-in-the-loop judgment means that a human remains accountable for how evidence is read, how context is understood, how ambiguity is handled, and how uncertainty is expressed. That role cannot be reduced to output. The crucial work is deciding what inputs mean in a specific situation, what is missing, what risks remain, and what consequences attach to error.
That kind of judgment depends on nuance. It depends on domain knowledge that is not only stored information, but also felt relevance and practical understanding. It depends on responsibility, because serious decisions are made by someone who bears consequences and must answer for them. It also depends on calibrated uncertainty, the ability to say not only what seems likely, but how likely, why it seems likely, and under what conditions the judgment should change.
This is a professional advantage in the deepest sense. The person who can hold context, detect ambiguity, and revise without collapsing into confusion is doing work that cannot be replaced by surface fluency. In fact, the more synthetic content improves at sounding authoritative, the more valuable the human layer becomes. When output becomes abundant, interpretation becomes precious. When plausibility becomes easy to manufacture, accountability becomes the distinguishing feature of real judgment.
To understand why this kind of protection is suddenly urgent, it helps to separate plausibility from truth. For a long time, people relied on a mixture of content and sensory cues to decide what seemed real. A voice carried traces of a speaker. An image seemed to capture a moment. A video appeared to preserve an event. A text that sounded informed suggested knowledgeable authorship. Those cues were never perfect, but they were often useful. In a synthetic media environment, those cues become less dependable. Text can be generated in convincing styles. Images can be assembled with persuasive detail. Audio can mimic tone and cadence. Video can create the impression of direct witness. None of this means every synthetic item is false. None of it means truth disappears. What it means is that plausibility can detach from underlying accuracy more easily than many people are accustomed to.
For ordinary observers, that creates a serious problem. The mind reacts to coherence, voice, image quality,
emotional resonance, and narrative structure. Yet those features no longer provide the same reassurance they once did. The result is a world where appearance and reality can diverge without obvious warning. This divergence becomes more powerful because the human mind does not wait patiently for formal verification before forming impressions. People often respond first to surface coherence. If the pieces of a message fit together smoothly, it can feel internally consistent. That feeling can arrive before the factual basis has been checked. People also respond to emotional fit, a claim that matches fear, hope, resentment, pride, or relief can feel right because it lands in an already prepared emotional space.
Narrative fluency matters too. When a story unfolds in a smooth, complete, intuitive way, it becomes easier to accept. The mind prefers what is easy to process. A fluent narrative reduces friction and helps a claim slide into place. None of these processes are exotic. They are normal features of human cognition. They become dangerous when high-quality fabrication and high-speed distribution take advantage of them at scale. A claim can feel true because it is easy to follow, because it confirms an expectation, because it arrives in a familiar format, or because it offers emotional closure. In that setting, the feeling of truth can arrive before truth-seeking.
The distribution side matters as much as the content side. Attention is finite, and because it is finite, it is economically valuable. A day contains limited focus. A mind contains limited working space. Any system that captures a larger share of attention gains influence over what gets noticed, what gets ignored, and what gets remembered. That is why attention is actively competed for by platforms, advertisers, influencers, political actors, and institutions. The competition does not look identical everywhere. It is not confined to one country, one platform, or one political culture. Across societies, technologies, and incentives vary. Yet the basic dynamic remains recognizable. Systems learn which signals keep people engaged. Then they reward the production and circulation of those signals.
Engagement-optimized distribution shapes the pathway content travels based on the reactions it generates. Content that triggers curiosity, anger, amusement, identification, or alarm often receives more visibility because it keeps people clicking, watching, revisiting, and sharing. So the environment does not present information neutrally. It continuously selects, ranks, and reintroduces what is most likely to hold attention. Repeated exposure changes what feels familiar. Familiarity can then influence what feels important, credible, or worth returning to. The distribution system therefore shapes not only what people see, it shapes what people remember, what they rehearse mentally, what they revisit later, and what eventually feels like common sense.
This is also why attention commodification is more than a slogan. When attention is treated as a resource to be extracted, the environment is organized around interruption, recurrence, and emotional salience. Content is not only designed to inform, it is often designed to compete, competing against boredom, rival narratives, silence, and the next item in the feed, as well as against the user's own intention to move on. Under those conditions, people do not simply choose beliefs in a calm marketplace of ideas. Impressions form inside engineered competition. The competition changes timing, emphasis, and repetition. It ensures that some frames arrive again and again, while others barely enter awareness. It encourages short cycles of reaction that leave little room for slow comparison.
Over time, judgment shifts toward what is most available in memory, because what is most available often feels most relevant. When a platform, campaign, or creator keeps a particular angle circulating, the angle gains cognitive momentum. It becomes easier to recall, easier to narrate, and easier to use as a lens for interpreting later events. In that way, engagement incentives do more than prioritize content. They help build the internal landscape through which later evidence,
is interpreted.
At this point, basic cognitive constraints become clearer. Human cognition is powerful, but it is not limitless. And its limits are not signs of personal failure. Working memory is limited. A person can only hold and manipulate a restricted amount of information at once. Complex verification, cross-checking, and comparison depend on that limited workspace. When too many claims, cues, or emotional reactions arrive together, inspection degrades. Attention is selective. To focus on one thing is to neglect many others. Every act of focus has an opportunity cost. If a striking claim captures attention, less remains available for context, alternatives, or source checking.
Executive control is effortful. Resisting distraction, suppressing impulsive reactions, maintaining a goal, and returning after interruption requires energy. It is not the mind's permanent resting state. Under fatigue or stress, executive control becomes harder to sustain. Belief updating is also shaped by prior expectations. New information does not enter an empty chamber. It is interpreted through existing models of the world, prior loyalties, learned fears, and assumptions about what kinds of sources are trustworthy. These constraints apply to everyone. They are universal features of how evidence is processed.
Once these constraints are recognized, source evaluation looks less like a single test of rationality and more like a sequence of early impressions that can harden quickly. People often form credibility judgments early, sometimes from source cues before the content is fully examined. The label, the style, the apparent expertise, the emotional tone, the visual polish, the familiarity of the messenger, or the social context in which a claim appears can all shape that first impression. Once a source is tagged as credible, ambiguities may be interpreted charitably. If a source is tagged as dubious, even accurate points can be dismissed too quickly. This does not mean first impressions are always wrong. It means they are consequential. They become filters that guide attention toward confirming details and away from disconfirming ones.
In a high-speed environment, those early filters often do more work than people realize. By the time contradictory information arrives, the mind may already have settled into a frame. Then the new information is processed through that frame rather than on neutral ground. That is one quiet reason belief revision is hard. Revision requires not only adding a fact, it often requires disturbing an interpretive setup that has already organized memory, emotion, and expectation. Media psychology adds another concept that helps explain this process: narrative transportation. Narrative transportation is a state in which a person becomes deeply engaged with a story and, for a time, reduces critical distance from it. When transportation is strong, the internal world of the narrative becomes vivid. Motives, conflict, and resolution pull attention inward. Analytic monitoring can soften.
Stories help people organize complexity. They compress events into causes, motives, and outcomes. They give emotional shape to uncertainty. In a synthetic and engagement-driven environment, compelling narratives travel well, whether they are accurate, distorted, or fabricated. A coherent narrative can outcompete a messy reality. Reality contains missing information, delayed confirmation, ambiguous motives, and unresolved contradictions. Narratives can remove friction. They can offer closure before closure is warranted. They can make uncertain events feel morally obvious or causally complete. When a person is transported into such a story, belief can be nudged by immersion itself. The story feels coherent, and the coherence can start to be treated as evidence. Coherence and evidence are not the same thing, but the distinction is easy to miss under immersion.
When these pressures accumulate, a broader syndrome begins to make sense. A useful term for it is reality fatigue.
This is not a single symptom. It is an interacting pattern of strain. One component is overload, simply too much to process, too quickly, across too many channels. Another component is emotional exhaustion, a constant diet of urgency, conflict, novelty, and alarm taxes the nervous system and dulls reflective patience. A third component is narrative confusion. Competing accounts circulate at speed. Corrections can mix with counterclaims. Sincere reporting can sit beside strategic framing, satire, fabrication, and commentary. The result is not always neat disagreement between two positions. Often it is a crowded field of overlapping stories that leaves the mind unsure which frame to trust.
A fourth component is belief calibration strain. Confidence is hard to match to evidence when evidence arrives unevenly, when source cues are unstable, and when emotionally loaded claims demand immediate reaction. People then face a repeated decision. Should this be believed strongly, weakly, or not at all? And should action follow now, or should judgment stay suspended? Making those calibrations repeatedly is mentally taxing. A fifth component is stress-related impairment. Under sustained stress, attention narrows, impulse control weakens, and the capacity for careful comparison can decline. These components reinforce one another. Overload increases exhaustion. Exhaustion reduces patience for ambiguity. Reduced patience can make simplified narratives more attractive. Simplified narratives can then increase overconfidence or confusion, which adds further strain.
Reality fatigue, then, is not only feeling tired of the news. It is a condition in which sorting reality becomes itself a site of pressure. This does not mean people are passive. Vulnerability here does not mean helplessness. It means that human cognition has entry points. Attention can be captured. Emotion can be recruited. Confidence can drift away from evidence. But passivity would mean there is nothing to do. That is false. Agency can be preserved and strengthened through design. People can build routines that reduce preventable load. They can shape environments so that not every claim arrives with equal urgency. They can rely on social supports instead of verifying everything alone. They can cultivate standards for when to trust, when to test, when to wait, and when to revise. They can create distance between first impression and final judgment.
In other words, they can construct the very protective infrastructure this lecture calls a cognitive firewall. The fact that the environment is pressuring judgment does not remove agency. It changes the form agency must take. Under simpler conditions, good intentions may be enough. Under more manipulative conditions, good intentions require structure. Clarity does not come only from willpower. It comes from making clarity easier to maintain and confusion harder to trigger. This is true for individuals, and it is also true for workplaces, teams, and institutions that depend on reliable judgment. Sound judgment is rarely produced by isolated effort alone. It is supported by procedures, norms, trusted relationships, and environments that reduce unnecessary cognitive strain.
Seen globally, this challenge is widespread, even though its local expression varies. Different societies have different histories, institutions, and patterns of trust. Different platforms emphasize different formats. Different political cultures reward different persuasion styles. Yet the underlying pressures recur across settings. Synthetic content lowers the cost of producing persuasive appearances. Engagement optimization rewards what holds attention. Human cognition remains selective, effortful, and vulnerable to early framing. Together, these conditions make the maintenance of epistemic agency a shared practical problem.
So the stakes of this lecture are now clear. The task is not to become permanently suspicious, emotionally numb, or detached from media. The task is to protect the ability to form and revise beliefs in a disciplined way. That ability depends on how attention is managed, how sources are evaluated, how stories are absorbed, and how uncertainty is carried. It depends on recognizing that plausibility is no longer a reliable stand-in for truth. It depends on understanding that attention is being competed for, and that this competition reshapes memory and familiarity. It depends on respecting the mind's limits rather than pretending they do not exist.
Most consequential decisions do not wait for perfect clarity. They require action before every ambiguity disappears. That means the goal is not absolute certainty. The goal is to hold a belief firmly enough to act, but lightly enough to revise. In the present environment, that balance becomes increasingly precious. It is the difference between being driven by whatever captures attention next and remaining capable of reasoned, accountable interpretation. To preserve that capacity, the pressures on cognition have to be understood in more detail. In the next part, the lecture moves from stakes to mechanisms, unpacking the cognitive and media processes that make epistemic agency harder to maintain and push people toward predictable failure modes.
The pressure described so far becomes easier to understand once it is translated into mechanism. Epistemic agency weakens not only because false or misleading claims exist, but because human cognition has predictable limits, and modern media systems repeatedly press on those limits. The key interaction is simple, even if its consequences are not. As the volume, speed, and emotional intensity of incoming material rise, the mind has less room for careful comparison. Under those conditions, people lean more heavily on shortcuts. They notice polish more than substance, familiarity more than novelty, emotional tone more than evidential quality, and source cues more than systematic analysis. This is not a character flaw. It is a normal response to strain.
A useful starting point is working memory. Working memory is the mind's limited workspace for holding and manipulating information in the moment. It is what allows a person to keep a claim in mind, compare it with another claim, remember where it came from, notice a contradiction, and still retain the question being asked. If that workspace is crowded, reasoning does not stop. It changes shape. The person can still form judgments, yet those judgments are more likely to depend on whatever is easiest to grasp right now. That may be a striking phrase, a confident tone, a familiar logo, a repeated talking point, or a feeling that the story hangs together. In a calm setting, those cues can be harmless starting points. In a saturated setting, they can become substitutes for evaluation.
This is why high information days feel different from low information ones. People often try to read, respond, and decide while attention is being pulled in multiple directions. The mind is not only processing content, it is also managing interruption, switching tasks, holding unfinished thoughts, and trying to recover context after each break. The result is cognitive load. Cognitive load simply means that the demands on mental processing are high relative to the capacity available in that moment. When load rises, people become more dependent on what is immediately accessible. They are less able to track nuance, weigh competing interpretations, or notice what is missing.
That matters because many judgments about truth are not made in one dramatic instant. They are assembled across small acts of comparison. A person asks whether a source has earned trust. They ask whether the timing is suspicious. They ask whether another explanation fits the facts better. They ask whether a claim is merely vivid or actually supported. They also ask whether confidence should remain provisional. Each of those steps requires mental space. When working memory is taxed, the mind often simplifies the task. Instead of comparing several possibilities, it settles quickly on one. Instead of holding uncertainty in place, it reaches for closure. Instead of checking whether a claim fits a wider pattern of evidence, it uses local coherence. Does this sound right? Does it fit what I already think? Does it feel familiar? Those are efficient questions. They are not always bad questions.
But by themselves,
They are not enough to protect judgment.
Working memory also helps explain why repetition is powerful. If a claim appears again and again, the mind does not have to work as hard to process it. It becomes fluent. Fluency creates ease, and ease can be mistaken for reliability. A familiar statement feels less effortful than an unfamiliar correction. Under low strain, a person may still stop and test that feeling. Under high strain, the ease itself can become persuasive. This is one reason repetition changes belief conditions even before it changes belief content. It alters what feels cognitively comfortable.
Closely related to working memory is executive function. Executive function is the set of capacities that supports attentional control, inhibition, planning, and task switching. It helps a person stay with a line of thought long enough to inspect it. It helps them resist an impulsive conclusion. It helps them redirect attention after distraction. It helps them choose a deliberate response instead of an automatic one. In daily life, executive function makes it possible to say, in effect, this claim can wait. This source needs checking. This emotional reaction is real, but not yet a verdict. And this conclusion is not ready to harden. Without that layer of control, the mind is carried more easily by whatever is most immediate.
Stress makes that control harder to maintain. Under stress, deliberate regulation becomes more effortful, and automatic responses become more dominant. That does not mean reasoning disappears. It means reasoning is more likely to be recruited in the service of rapid protection rather than careful evaluation. The mind becomes readier to detect threat, quicker to favor what seems familiar, and less willing to spend scarce energy on ambiguity. This can be adaptive in some circumstances. If danger is immediate, slow reflection can be costly. But an information environment can borrow some of the same machinery. It can keep attention in a defensive posture, even when the threat is interpretive rather than physical.
Arousal and threat physiology help explain why. When people are highly aroused, attention often narrows. Vigilance increases. Signals that imply danger, conflict, betrayal, or urgency become harder to ignore. In that state, existing beliefs can feel more protective because they provide a ready-made map. They tell a person what kind of world this is, who is trustworthy, what counts as evidence, and where danger is likely to come from. That map may be accurate, partly accurate, or inaccurate. The important point is that under stress, a settled map can feel safer than an open question. The mind then gets pulled not only toward answers, but toward answers that reduce uncertainty quickly.
This creates a natural bridge to confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is the tendency to search for, notice, remember, and interpret information in ways that fit existing beliefs more easily than information that challenges them. It is often described as if it belongs mainly to uninformed people. Research in psychology and decision-making suggests otherwise. Confirmation bias appears across education levels, and it can affect experts as well, especially when a topic is complex, ambiguous, professionally consequential, or tied to identity. Knowledge does not remove the mechanism. In some cases, knowledge can supply more tools for defending an early conclusion.
Under cognitive load, emotional arousal, and uncertainty, confirmation bias often intensifies. This is not mysterious. Disconfirming evidence is harder work. It requires holding two possibilities in mind, tolerating friction, and resisting the relief that comes from quick alignment with prior belief. When the mind is tired or stressed, that work becomes less attractive. Congenial information, by contrast, is easier to integrate. It fits the existing frame. It asks for less restructuring. So the mind may treat supportive evidence as decisive and contradictory evidence as peripheral, flawed, or suspicious. In practice, the same feed, event, or report
can feel different depending on the frame already in place.
Motivated reasoning pushes this process further. Motivated reasoning is defensive processing in which conclusions connected to identity, status, values, group loyalty, or emotional safety receive special protection. The key word here is not always conscious intention. It is motivation in the broader sense of what the mind is organized to preserve. If accepting a claim would threaten a valued identity, weaken a group bond, introduce shame, or create social risk, the claim meets more internal resistance. If accepting a claim would support belonging, moral self-image, or emotional security, the path can feel smoother. This can happen automatically. A person may sincerely experience the process as fair-minded evaluation, even while filtering has already begun.
That point matters, because motivated reasoning is often mistaken for bad faith. Of course, some persuasion is strategic. Some actors knowingly distort. But the mechanism under discussion here does not require dishonesty. People can be deeply sincere and still process information defensively. In fact, sincerity can make the mechanism harder to detect. If the person feels careful and conscientious, then disagreement can feel like proof of the other side's blindness rather than evidence of one's own vulnerability. This is one reason epistemic agency cannot rest only on self-confidence. Feeling rigorous is not the same as being rigorous. Under identity pressure, the mind can generate convincing reasons after a conclusion has already become emotionally necessary.
Source judgment introduces another layer. In fast information environments, credibility judgments often lock in early. Before content is fully examined, the mind forms an impression from style, affiliation, familiarity, tone, visual polish, social endorsement, or prior trust. That first impression then colors the interpretation of everything that follows. If the source is tagged as trustworthy, ambiguities are interpreted more charitably. Weaknesses may be excused as minor. If the source is tagged as untrustworthy, accurate details can be brushed aside. Familiarity also matters. A source that has appeared often can feel safer simply because it is known. The halo effect contributes too. A positive impression in one area, such as confidence or perceived expertise, can spread into broader judgments about reliability.
Once that source impression settles, later evidence rarely enters neutral space. It enters a trust relationship or a distrust relationship that is already doing interpretive work. This is why the first layer of a cognitive firewall is often not advanced analysis. It is input curation. Where is attention allowed to land in the first place? Which channels receive repeated exposure? Which voices get the chance to define the opening frame? If a person repeatedly gives early attention to sources that trade in distortion, outrage, or strategic ambiguity, later correction becomes more difficult. The problem is no longer only whether a single claim is true. The problem is that an entire interpretive environment may have begun to form.
Research on misinformation shows how durable these early effects can be. One well-studied pattern is the continued influence effect. False information can continue shaping memory and reasoning even after explicit correction. The correction is heard. It may even be accepted at the time. Yet the original claim leaves a trace that remains available later. When people try to explain an event, remember what happened, or fill a gap in understanding, the misinformation can still supply material. Memory does not operate like clean deletion. Once a claim has organized a story, removing it leaves a hole.
That is why debunking does not simply erase misinformation. A correction must compete with the original claim's accessibility, fluency, and narrative usefulness. If the false claim was vivid, emotionally loaded, or repeated many times, it has already gained cognitive momentum. It is easier to retrieve.
It may offer a neat causal explanation. It may fit an existing worldview. A bare correction can therefore feel weaker than the falsehood it answers, even when the correction is better supported. The mind is comparing not only evidence, but usability. Which explanation is easier to retrieve? Which one feels more complete? Which one seems to explain why events unfolded as they did?
For that reason, corrections often work better when they include a plausible alternative explanation for why the misinformation seemed believable in the first place. If misinformation is removed, but nothing coherent replaces it, the mind has to manage uncertainty without support. Gaps are uncomfortable, and people naturally try to fill them. An effective correction is not only subtraction, it is replacement with a better account. This does not guarantee success, but it improves the conditions under which revision can happen.
Timing matters as well. Earlier corrections typically have more promise because they intervene before the false claim becomes fully woven into memory, conversation, and identity. Source credibility matters too. Corrections from trusted sources are easier to receive than corrections from distrusted ones, even when both are equally accurate. Context matters because people do not absorb corrections in the abstract. They absorb them within relationships, groups, and prior assumptions about who is trying to help and who is trying to manipulate. A correction that ignores those conditions can be psychologically weak, even when it is factually strong.
This brings up the delicate issue of backfire effects. Public discussion sometimes gives the impression that corrections usually strengthen false beliefs. The research picture is more careful than that. Corrections can sometimes harden resistance, especially when they trigger identity threat or are experienced as status attack. But this is not a universal law. Many corrections do help. The important point is that correction is context-dependent. Its success depends on timing, trust, framing, narrative fit, and the social meaning attached to belief change. If revising a belief feels like betrayal, humiliation, or expulsion from a valued group, evidence alone may struggle to carry the day.
Narrative transportation makes this harder still. When a story is emotionally engaging, people can become absorbed to the point where counter-arguing softens. Attention is drawn inward toward plot, motive, and emotional resolution. The story does not arrive as a list of claims to inspect one by one. It arrives as an experience. That experience can be memorable and persuasive, even if specific factual elements are weak. Later correction then faces a difficult task. It is not challenging a detached proposition. It is challenging a felt sequence that has already organized meaning. This helps explain why some false or distorted narratives remain sticky. They are not remembered only as statements. They are remembered as worlds.
Identity relevance amplifies the effect. When a narrative says something about who people are, who belongs, who threatens them, who is innocent, or who is corrupt, belief revision becomes socially and emotionally loaded. The question is no longer only whether a factual detail is right. The question becomes what acceptance or rejection implies about loyalty, dignity, fear, status, or moral orientation. Under those conditions, changing one's mind can feel like changing one's side. That is a much bigger psychological demand. It makes correction harder, and it makes certainty more tempting, because certainty can protect belonging.
At this point, media design returns to the center of the picture. Recommendation systems in an attention economy are commonly optimized for engagement. Engagement is not identical to truth, depth, or reliability. It often tracks emotion, novelty, conflict, surprise, repeated interaction, and the likelihood that a person will stay, click, comment, share, or return. As a result, content that provokes strong reactions can receive disproportionate visibility,
This does not mean every platform operates identically. It does mean the incentive structure tends to reward what keeps people involved, and intense material often does that efficiently.
Algorithmic amplification therefore matters because it shapes exposure before conscious evaluation even begins. It increases the chance that emotionally charged, polarizing, or highly repeatable material enters awareness again and again. Repetition, as we have seen, increases familiarity. Familiarity increases fluency. Fluency can increase perceived plausibility. The sequence is not mechanical, but it is influential. Recommendation systems do not have to command belief directly. They only have to alter what is repeatedly available for consideration.
The language of filter bubbles and echo chambers tries to describe this problem, but the story is more debated than casual discussion often suggests. It is well supported that engagement systems shape exposure. It is also well supported that people often choose information that feels congenial to existing views. Social clustering matters too. People gather in networks of trust, affiliation, and shared identity, and those networks influence what circulates. What is less settled is the relative contribution of each factor in each setting. On some platforms, algorithmic sorting may play a larger role. In other cases, user preference, social ties, or topic-specific communities may matter more. The overall effect is real, but it is multi-cause rather than single-cause.
That distinction matters because it prevents a misleading simplification. It would be easy to blame everything on algorithms and ignore human choice. It would be equally easy to blame everything on users and ignore platform design. The evidence points to interaction. Systems shape what is available and salient. Users bring prior preferences, emotional needs, identities, and habits of attention. Social groups provide reinforcement. The information environment that results is neither fully imposed from above nor fully chosen from below. It is co-produced. For epistemic agency, the challenge is therefore not only resisting one bad actor, it is understanding a whole ecology of selection and reinforcement.
Reality fatigue becomes intelligible inside that ecology. A mind can be crowded by too much material, too much urgency, too much emotional intensity, and too many competing narratives. It can also be drained by repeated calibration, especially when source cues are unstable and when emotionally loaded claims demand immediate reaction. Over time, stress narrows attention and weakens the capacity for careful comparison. When uncertainty feels uncomfortable, familiar frames become easier to treat as reality.
Doom scrolling offers a vivid example of this feedback loop, even if the exact causal pattern can vary from person to person. Threat-related information captures attention automatically. Distressing headlines, alarming commentary, and conflict-heavy updates pull the mind back for another check, another refresh, another attempt to regain orientation. But distress can increase monitoring, and increased monitoring can increase exposure. More exposure can deepen distress, especially when the material is negative, unresolved, and repetitive. The person continues scrolling partly to reduce uncertainty, yet the process can end up increasing it. The feed feels impossible to leave because the next item might clarify everything. Instead, it often adds one more fragment.
Even with that uncertainty about causality, the practical significance for epistemic agency is straightforward. A mind locked into threat monitoring has less room for reflection, comparison, and disciplined uncertainty. It becomes easier to confuse staying close to the stream with staying close to reality. Seen together, these mechanisms form a converging system. Synthetic plausibility increases the volume of material that looks finished and coherent. Engagement design intensifies emotional exposure by favoring what triggers reaction and return. Working memory limits reduce the number of elements that can be actively compared at once.
Executive function strain makes inhibition, planning, and attentional control harder to sustain. Stress narrows attention and strengthens the appeal of familiar frames.
Confirmation bias and motivated reasoning protect existing beliefs, especially when they are tied to identity or safety. Early source impressions lock in trust or distrust. Misinformation persists because correction must overcome not only factual error, but memory traces and narrative usefulness. Immersive stories reduce counter-arguing. Social clustering and selective exposure reinforce what already feels true. Reality fatigue then lowers the energy available for repair.
The result is not that people lose the capacity for judgment altogether. It is that the conditions for good judgment deteriorate in patterned ways. The mind is asked to do its most careful work in environments that reward speed, certainty, emotion, and recurrence. Under those pressures, epistemic agency is not defeated by one dramatic deception alone. More often, it is worn down by accumulation. Too much enters, too quickly, too vividly, under too much stress. If that erosion is to be resisted, the answer cannot be a demand for infinite vigilance. It has to be a form of protection that respects how cognition actually works. Once these mechanisms are visible, the problem becomes clearer, and so does the path toward building habits and environments that keep belief formation from being driven entirely by whatever captures attention next.
In the next part, the lecture moves from mechanisms to protection. It translates these cognitive and media pressures into practical routines for preserving attention, improving investigation, and supporting long-term mental clarity, so that belief revision remains possible even under sustained informational strain. The practical question now is what a cognitive firewall looks like when it becomes a daily habit rather than a metaphor. The answer is less dramatic than total skepticism, and it is more useful. A working firewall does not promise perfect immunity from error. No human mind gets that. Its purpose is narrower and stronger. It gives a person better control over attention, over which evidence is sampled, over how much confidence is attached to a claim, and over when belief should be revised.
That is the standard worth aiming for in a synthetic media environment. Not purity, not flawless detection, not withdrawal from public life. The real aim is to keep judgment accountable to evidence, even when the environment rewards speed, emotion, and repetition. Once the mechanisms of strain are visible, the next step is to convert them into routines that protect the main bottlenecks. Those bottlenecks include cognitive load, stress arousal, rapid heuristic processing, source lock-in, and the persistence of misinformation after it has already entered memory.
A useful framework for a high information day is simple enough to remember and demanding enough to matter. Before exposure, the firewall manages intake. During exposure, it manages interpretation. After exposure, it manages calibration and learning. This sequence matters because different failures show up at different moments. Some errors begin before a claim is even encountered, when attention is already fragmented and urgency has already been installed by alerts, interruptions, and constant checking. Other errors happen in the middle of exposure, when a vivid claim arrives and the mind moves too quickly from impression to endorsement. Still other errors happen afterward, when a person remembers being correct more often than was actually the case, or fails to learn from a predictable mistake.
A durable cognitive firewall does not rely on one heroic act of skepticism. It reshapes the conditions under which judgment happens. It chooses the tempo of intake. It changes what questions are asked in the moment. It uses a disciplined method for review once the moment has passed. Before exposure, one of the most protective decisions is to reduce preventable load. That begins with choosing information windows, rather than letting information arrive whenever a platform or device demands attention. A bounded window does not mean indifference. It means that timing
is placed back under human control.
If every notification has permission to interrupt, then urgency becomes the default setting of the day, and whatever is loudest captures the first claim on working memory. Limiting unnecessary notifications does more than reduce annoyance. It preserves attentional control. It keeps interruption from impersonating importance. On a crowded day, this matters because every switch in attention has a cost. Context has to be rebuilt. Unfinished thoughts have to be recovered. Emotional residue from one item can leak into the next. By setting windows for intake, a person lowers the chance that interpretation happens in a permanent state of partial distraction.
The practical goal is not to know less. It is to encounter what matters under conditions that make comparison and restraint more possible. Before exposure also means deciding what the day is actually for. Without priority questions, the feed chooses the agenda. With priority questions, attention has a filter. A person can ask, what must be understood today? What decision depends on reliable information? And what can remain unresolved for now? That small act is protective because it prevents endless lateral drift from one provocative item to another.
It also improves evidence sampling. If the task is to understand a policy change, then reporting and documentation relevant to that change deserve attention. If the task is to assess a developing event, then verified updates matter more than early speculation. In other words, the question comes first, and the stream comes second. This is one of the cleanest ways to resist source lock-in and narrative capture. The mind is less likely to absorb whatever is most vivid when it already knows what it is trying to find out. Priority questions create a standard for relevance before emotion gets to define relevance on its own.
Source choice belongs to this preparatory stage, and it is a high-leverage decision. Earlier parts of the lecture have already shown that first credibility judgments can harden quickly. That means initial source selection often matters more than people assume. If an unreliable or manipulative source supplies the opening frame, later correction has to climb a steep hill.
A practical firewall treats source choice as part of reasoning, not as something external to reasoning. It helps to choose sources intentionally, diversify exposure, and separate reporting from commentary when that separation is possible. Reporting aims at its best to establish what happened. Commentary aims to interpret what happened, explain what it means, or argue about what should follow. Both can have value, but they are not interchangeable. If commentary arrives before basic reporting is stable, interpretation can become anchored to a story that does not yet have firm evidence beneath it. Diversification matters for a related reason. It reduces dependence on one reporting chain, one editorial culture, or one familiar voice. The point is not to create artificial balance at every moment. The point is to lower the risk that one narrow frame quietly becomes the whole informational world.
This is where lateral reading becomes a central verbal routine. When a claim matters, the wise move is often to leave the claim's immediate presentation rather than stare at it more intensely. In a synthetic media environment, polish can be abundant. Surface coherence can be manufactured. So the relevant question is rarely whether the page, post, clip, or speaker looks convincing from the inside. The better question is how other credible sources describe the source, the event, and the evidence. Who is making the claim? What is known about that source outside its own presentation? Are other outlets with independent standards reporting the same event? Are they describing the same core facts or only echoing a striking phrase? Is there original evidence behind the summary or only layers of repetition?
Lateral reading is powerful, precisely because it interrupts the spell of immediate presentation. It moves judgment from appearance to context. It does not require endless investigation of every minor item. It applies most strongly when the claim is consequential, emotionally charged, highly shareable, or potentially costly if believed too quickly.
cross-checking deepens that protection. In ordinary conversation, people sometimes treat multiple reports as if they automatically count as multiple confirmations. In practice, that is not always true. Several sources may trace back to the same origin. An identical clip may be repackaged across many accounts. A single early report may be paraphrased so many times that repetition starts to look like corroboration.
A strong firewall, therefore, asks whether sources are genuinely independent. It also looks for original evidence when that is feasible. Depending on the case, original evidence might mean a full statement rather than a clipped excerpt, a primary document rather than a paraphrase, a full recording rather than a fragment, or the original release rather than commentary about the release. This does not guarantee certainty. It does counter one of the major dangers described earlier, the decoupling of plausibility from truth. A claim does not become more trustworthy simply because many copies exist. Truth still depends on whether independent lines of evidence converge.
A similar principle supports pre-bunking, which is one of the most useful anticipatory strategies available in a crowded information environment. Pre-bunking means learning common manipulation tactics before encountering them in the wild. Instead of waiting to debunk every false or misleading claim after exposure, a person trains attention to recognize the form of manipulation early.
Several recurring tactics deserve special notice. A false dilemma compresses a complicated situation into only two options and pressures immediate choice. Emotional bait is designed less to inform than to trigger anger, fear, disgust, triumph, or moral panic. Impersonated authority borrows the symbols, language, or tone of expertise without earning the underlying credibility. Conspiracy patterns turn missing evidence into proof of a cover-up and make disconfirmation look like confirmation. Misleading context uses a real quote, image, or event, but places it in the wrong frame, the wrong time, or the wrong causal story. Learning these patterns in advance can be more useful than relying only on later debunking, because once a claim is encoded as part of a narrative, correction has to work uphill. Pre-bunking lowers the chance that the original impression becomes deeply lodged in the first place.
Debunking still matters, especially when correction is possible and evidence is available. But timing and psychological fit determine how well correction can compete. If the mind has already treated the claim as part of an organized story, a bare factual correction may not be enough. That is why prevention often outperforms repair. When exposure is actually happening, the firewall changes function. The main goal is to slow interpretive moments without trying to inspect every trivial detail. A critical move is often a brief delay between impression and commitment. If a claim feels urgent, outrageous, flattering, or vindicating, that is a signal to slow down rather than speed up.
One protective routine is to name the emotional state plainly. Anger, alarm, relief, excitement, and moral certainty are real experiences, but they are not the same thing as proof. Naming the feeling creates a small distance from it. A second routine is to state current confidence explicitly, even if only internally. Is confidence low, moderate, or high? Is the judgment provisional, or is the evidence already strong enough to justify firmer belief? A third routine is to separate what is known from what is inferred. What is directly supported by available evidence? What is interpretation? What is merely suspected? Clarity often returns at this boundary. It interrupts the common slide from observation to story, without any felt transition between them.
Another useful question in the moment is what evidence would change the current interpretation? This question tests whether the mind is still open to revision or whether confidence has already fused to identity or emotion. If no possible evidence could matter,
then judgment is no longer being held in an accountable way. Asking what could change the conclusion reintroduces conditional thinking. It reminds the mind that belief strength should track support, not just immediate fit.
This routine becomes especially valuable before sharing. Sharing recruits social identity, public commitment, and future defensiveness. Once a person has endorsed a claim in front of others, revision can feel more costly. That is why a pause before sharing is often more protective than a pause before private belief alone. The goal is not silence about everything. The goal is to avoid moving from exposure to amplification before uncertainty has even been named. A professional habit that strengthens this pause is structured alternatives generation. Before settling on an interpretation, a person can require at least two plausible explanations that would fit the evidence differently. One explanation may still be correct. The point is to keep first impressions from becoming monopolies.
A striking clip might support the obvious interpretation, but it might also reflect selective editing, missing context, mistaken timing, or an early report that will look different once fuller evidence appears. A source's confident tone might indicate real expertise, but it might also reflect practiced fluency without adequate support. A rapidly spreading claim might indicate importance, but it might also indicate emotional transmissibility. By generating alternatives, a person weakens confirmation bias and resists the tendency to confuse the first coherent story with the only coherent story. Responsible interpretation is not the same as reaction. Strong interpretations should survive comparison, not just arrive first.
Because epistemic agency can erode gradually, a person also needs markers that indicate when judgment is beginning to slip. These markers often do not show up as obvious falsehoods. They show up as changes in one's own cognitive and emotional state. One marker is an overconfidence spike under heavy load, when patience for ambiguity disappears and everything suddenly feels obvious. Another is urgency to share, especially before source checking has happened. Another is narrowed attention during threat, when one angle of a situation consumes the whole field and alternative explanations feel not only wrong, but irritating.
Irritability at contrary evidence is itself a warning sign. So is a craving for total certainty, because the desire to eliminate uncertainty can become stronger than the evidence warrants. These are diagnostic signals, not moral failures. They indicate that arousal, fatigue, identity pressure, or overload may already be steering the process. Recognizing them is part of the firewall. If a system can detect its own strain, it can respond before strain fully determines the outcome. The response should be practical rather than theatrical. Reduce input volume. Step away from emotionally charged feeds. Return to trusted sources with clearer standards. Postpone high-stakes judgments when postponement is possible. This can be misunderstood as avoidance, but it is often the opposite. It is a refusal to let the worst cognitive conditions dictate the most consequential conclusions.
A cognitive firewall cannot be purely analytical. It also depends on cognitive regulation in a broader sense. Attentional control matters because the mind has to stay with a question long enough to compare claims instead of being pulled away by every interruption. Inhibition matters because a person must sometimes suppress the impulse to click, endorse, reply, or conclude immediately. Working memory limits matter because too many active threads at once degrade comparison, even when intentions are good. Stress arousal matters because it narrows attention and increases the appeal of fast closure. Sleep and recovery matter because the capacities required for disciplined evaluation are embodied capacities, not abstract ideals floating above the nervous system. Sustained focus matters because careful verification and comparison rarely happen inside brief fragments of distracted time.
Seen in this light, Epistemic agency is partly a matter of how the day is organized. The person who never exits alert mode eventually reasons inside the tempo of the feed. The person who protects intervals of concentrated thought preserves the conditions under which slower judgment can still occur. Long-term attention hygiene follows from this. Protecting deep work protects more than productivity. It protects a mode of thinking in which complex material can be held, compared, and revised without constant interruption. Scheduling recovery recognizes that depletion changes cognition. Reducing compulsive exposure prevents the environment from converting every spare moment into another cycle of stimulation and appraisal.
A deliberate relationship with feeds and alerts keeps them in their proper role. Not every update deserves entry into the same mental room where consequential beliefs are formed. Some information is genuinely urgent. Much of it only feels urgent because the delivery channel is optimized to create that feeling. Stable judgment requires the ability to tell the difference. That ability is easier to maintain when attention has protected spaces, when interruption is not constant, and when there is some distance from systems that profit from perpetual re-entry. After exposure, the firewall becomes a calibration system. This stage is often neglected because once the immediate moment passes, people understandably want to move on. Yet without review, the same preventable errors repeat.
Calibration begins with making predictions explicit and attaching confidence levels to them. The prediction does not have to be grand. It can be a judgment that a claim will hold up after further reporting, that a source will prove reliable or unreliable in this instance, or that a dramatic interpretation will weaken once more context appears. What matters is that confidence becomes visible rather than remaining a vague feeling. Later, when outcomes are clearer, the person revisits the prediction and compares confidence with accuracy. Was high confidence justified? Was a low confidence judgment too timid? Was the person correct for the right reason, or only by accident? Over time, this builds a practical map of where confidence tends to outrun evidence and where hesitation may be excessive.
The goal is not self-surveillance for its own sake. It is a trainable relationship between how sure one feels and how often that level of assurance proves warranted. Calibration is trainable, but it is not magically universal. A person may be well calibrated in one domain because repeated feedback exists there, while remaining poorly calibrated in another domain that only feels familiar. That matters because fluent access to information can create an illusion of transferable competence. Calibration practice pushes back against that illusion. It shows where accuracy is stable, where confidence is borrowing authority from the wrong place, and where the standards of evidence actually differ.
An error learning loop turns review into refinement. When a judgment goes wrong, the useful question is not only whether the conclusion was mistaken. The more informative question is what kind of failure produced the mistake. Did cognitive load cause too much to be processed at once? Did bias narrow what was noticed? Did poor source choice install a misleading frame early? Did narrative transportation make a story feel truer than the evidence supported? Did stress reduce tolerance for ambiguity? Was key expertise missing so that surface cues did more work than domain knowledge could properly validate?
A good review captures the error, diagnoses the likely cause, and then adjusts the routine. Perhaps the lesson is to slow down before sharing. Perhaps it is to improve source selection. Perhaps it is to stop treating commentary as primary evidence. Perhaps it is to recognize that a particular topic reliably triggers defensive reasoning and therefore requires stronger safeguards. Errors become costly mainly when they remain uninterpreted.
Once they become data about process, they can strengthen the firewall that failed to catch them. No individual, however disciplined, can carry this burden alone all the time. That is why social scaffolding deserves explicit attention. Trusted people, professional peers, institutional signals, editorial standards, and domain experts can all serve as external calibration when solo evaluation is unreliable.
This does not mean outsourcing judgment completely. It means using structured trust to extend human oversight beyond one person's cognitive limits. Editorial standards matter because they indicate whether claims pass through verification, correction, and accountability. Institutional signals matter because some organizations show over time whether they distinguish evidence from assertion and whether they correct visibly. Professional peers can catch blind spots within a shared domain of practice. Domain experts matter because expertise includes methods for handling uncertainty, not just possession of facts. Trusted people matter as well because social isolation can intensify error, while carefully chosen relationships can provide reality checks that an overloaded individual cannot generate alone.
The key is that scaffolding must be structured. Trust should not be granted merely on the basis of affinity, familiarity, or emotional comfort. It should be linked to demonstrated standards. Does the source revise when warranted? Does the expert stay within relevant methods and acknowledge uncertainty? Does the institution show its work by distinguishing what is known from what is unsettled, and by maintaining norms of correction and accountability? Structured trust extends judgment. Unstructured trust relocates vulnerability. In that sense, epistemic agency is compatible with dependence, but dependence needs to be organized around credible methods.
Long-term epistemic autonomy, therefore, depends on more than spotting individual falsehoods. It depends on maintaining a sustainable relationship to attention itself, protecting deep work, scheduling recovery, reducing compulsive exposure, and keeping feeds and alerts in a subordinate role all support that autonomy. So does periodic belief review.
Consequential beliefs should be revisited from time to time, especially when they begin to feel like permanent parts of identity rather than revisable interpretations. A useful review asks what new evidence has emerged, what evidence has weakened, what has not been tested recently, and which beliefs are becoming identity protective rather than evidence responsive. Once a belief becomes a badge of self rather than a conclusion about the world, correction becomes much harder. The mind starts defending the person through the belief rather than evaluating the belief for the sake of accuracy. A cognitive firewall does not eliminate identity. It simply prevents identity from quietly becoming the sole court of appeal.
Stable internal standards are the lasting backbone of this architecture. A person should know in advance what counts as good evidence, what counts as credible expertise, what responsible uncertainty sounds like, and what level of support is enough to justify action. Without such standards, each new claim resets the terms of judgment. Mood, pace, affiliation, and rhetorical style then decide what feels convincing. With stable standards, evaluation becomes less reactive. Good evidence is not merely vivid or repeated. It is support that can be traced, compared, and placed in context. Credible expertise is not just prestige or confidence. It includes relevant competence, a defensible method, and a norm of correction. Responsible uncertainty is neither bluster nor shrugging confusion. It is the ability to state what is known, what is not known, and why the boundary matters.
Sufficient reason to act does not require perfect certainty. It does require that confidence be proportionate to the evidence available and to the consequences of getting the judgment wrong. These standards do not remove difficulty. They keep difficulty from turning into chaos.
Several open issues remain important because progress requires avoiding false closure. Consider how corrections function when they arrive late, after misinformation has already become tied to memory narrative, or identity. Consider how framing should respect social meaning when beliefs carry status and belonging beyond factual content. Consider how to separate, with greater precision, the role of algorithmic sorting from the role of user preference and social clustering in shaping homogeneous information diets. These questions shape public discourse, platform governance, journalism, and professional standards. They reinforce a key point: preserving epistemic agency is not a one-time solution. It is ongoing practice in an evolving environment.
Still, the core promise is clear enough to stand. A cognitive firewall does not offer certainty. It does not offer purity. It does not ask for withdrawal from complexity. It offers sustained agency over how attention is directed, how evidence is sampled, how confidence is calibrated, and how judgment stays answerable to revision under pressure. In a world where plausibility can be manufactured and engagement can be engineered, the decisive skill is not never being wrong. It is building conditions under which it is less easy to be pushed, more careful about what enters, more honest about uncertainty, and more willing to revise when better evidence appears.
That is what epistemic agency looks like in practice. It is not a permanent state of suspicion. It is a disciplined form of freedom. Sources: Cowan, 2001, and Baddeley, 2012, grounded the discussion of working memory and why attention gets overloaded so quickly. Arnston, McEwen, Phelps and Ledoux, and Ocon Singer and colleagues helped explain how stress and threat narrow attention and weaken deliberate control. Wasson, Nickerson, Tabor and Lodge, and Ditto and Lopez anchored the sections on confirmation bias and motivated reasoning. These sources show that people do not process evidence neutrally, especially when beliefs are tied to identity, status, or emotion.
Lewandowski and colleagues, Thorson, Wood and Porter, and Guess and colleagues informed the discussion of misinformation, correction, and the continued influence of false claims. Rosenbeek and Bossel also shaped the section on pre-bunking and inoculation, where the key idea is that people can be trained against manipulation before they meet it. Green and Brock, Appel and Richter, and Dahlstrom supported the material on narrative transportation. Their work helped show why a coherent story can feel more convincing than a dry correction, especially when the topic is personally or politically charged. Westerlund, Mirsky and Lee, and recent technical evaluations from OpenAI, Anthropic, and related academic work supported the discussion of deepfakes and synthetic media. These sources helped frame the growing gap between how plausible generated content looks and how hard it is to verify without outside checks.
Sunstein, Pariser, Geschke and colleagues, Brady and colleagues, and Geis and colleagues informed the sections on filter bubbles, selective exposure, and engagement-driven feeds. Internal platform disclosures, including the Facebook papers, were used only as background on how attention incentives shape what gets amplified. Fricker, along with Alfano and colleagues, provided the philosophical frame for epistemic agency and autonomy. Premack, Verdun, Martyr, Soroka, and McAdams helped ground the discussion of news overload, doom scrolling, and reality fatigue as a mix of stress, confusion, and decision strain. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.